Hello and welcome to Podcast on Fire. I'm your host, Stuart Sutherland, and joining me tonight for this special episode is Ken.
Hey.
And Jared.
Hey.
So, tonight is really just a benefit special. This is us just trying to think of a way how we could help those which have just, well, help people out in this crazy time now with everything that's going on in Japan. So I'd like to take this moment to thank you for sending a donation for this cause, and hopefully over the next 3 hours we could like reward you with Anakin, some funny jokes, no more bong jokes.
Well, no tsunami jokes either.
Definitely no. Nah, come on. If you are really one of those, I'm sure there's Charlie Sheen talking about it somewhere. But anyway, no, resist any temptation. So tonight we are going to just talk about things that you really actually want to hear. Like in our second hour, we've got our discussion of like Sammo Hung movies, like favorite Sammo Hung movies with me, Ken, Mike Maley, and Phil Gillen. Like Sammo Hung talk. That's a rarity on our podcast normally. And for the third hour, we're going to be talking about the Korean thriller, The Chaser, with Martin Cleary, Ken again, and let's see, I think we'll have Paul Quinn from Hangul Celluloid phoning in, and maybe we might hear from Rufus as well. So, I mean, thank you for donating, and this is your reward. Also, you might have heard about this already, but I did get my legs waxed at this time. It was mere hours ago, and the videos are pretty funny. I squeal like a bitch. So, along with this contact, you would have received these links via email. On that email, there should be a direct link to the two videos of me being tortured in my place of work, no less.
I like it should be.
You want to see your podcast being humiliated and whimpering like a little girl? Well, we fucking got it for you.
For a good cause times two.
Yeah.
So, you know, kudos to you still for suffering in the name of a good cause, a good charity.
Yeah, it was fun. And it raised over £200 as well, which was insane. So, like, fucking yay.
Good people. So, good people out there. Bless you all. Bless you all.
So, we're going to start tonight with... we're basically just going to grill Jared.
Oh,
this is the first time I've gotten on the show with him. And I just listened to like the great part both of you had done on podcast of...
Yeah, what's it called?
Loyalty Without Dishonor. Podcast of Young and Dangerous. I don't know. Jake, I'm sorry. So sorry.
I can dub it in for you.
Yes. Podcast
Without Honor and Humanity.
There we are. Yes.
Right.
I would obviously know about the one on my network.
Okay.
Yes. I
would forgive you for that, though, because our network is kind of expanding and getting bigger.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I take it back to the part of me saying it's my network. I am in my business right now.
You are the CEO of the network, so do call it yours. Like, own it!
But yes, you did have this great top three segments for the show where you talked about these movies I had absolutely no idea about.
Well, you should really watch them. I mean, isn't it a great image in your mind?
Tell them. Yeah. But I'll have to listen to the podcast extra slowly and write it down. But I want to start off on the same theme. I want to get another top three out of Jared.
Oh, and, crap.
Yep, I'm getting you on the spot.
Top
Jared,
three crap.
This is mandatory. I want to know your top three Eakin Cheng haircuts and why.
Does he
have
free haircuts?
Who's Eakin Cheng?
No!
You're not fit to be on our network.
Hello. Yes, I fixed it. I think what came over me.
I thought that was one of the shows. Who's Eakin Cheng? Oh, that's What's Korean Cinema. Ah, that's it.
Well, the Eken Hour. You should really do the Eken Hour. I would love to hear that. Could you do like a weekly Eken Hour? And it would be awesome. Like a fucking like Paris Hilton Team Scene kind of show, you know? Just gossip. We heard from reliable sources in Hong Kong that Eken was seen here and there walking with his girlfriend. They might be together, they might not be. Let's draw something silly on the picture we took.
TMZ.
Yeah.
So, Jared, best friend, buddy, old pal of mine, tell us a little bit about your website.
Okay, the website, I guess it's a little over a year old. It's called Bullets Over Chinatown. Just pretty much I was accumulating all of this Hong Kong movie crap, just movies, posters, just some minor memorabilia, and it was just collecting dust in my apartment. It was pushed into, you know, closets, and I had boxes stacked to the ceiling. I said, you know, I got to do something with this garbage. You know, maybe people want to see it, you know. So I just decided to really make a cheesy little blog, take pictures of posters and some obscure VCDs and DVDs and VHS that I've accumulated over the years, and just put it up and hope people responded, and some of them did.
So a lot more than the average review blog.
Yeah, I'm not a big reviewer. I don't really care for reviews. Yeah, well, I frequent, you know, Kent's site, of course, and I do like, you know, love Hong Kong film, and but I'm not a big review reader. I don't want people to tell me how to think about a movie or you know what to see. If I want to see it, I'm going to see it, and I'll decide. So I kind of keep the reviews to a minimum, and when I do reviews, I kind of make them funny and a little bit salty, just for people's amusement. Yeah,
well, it's unavoidable, isn't it? That you know that they get salty, if you will, because I connect that salty to word naughty and erotic and category three.
Yeah.
So I mean.
Yeah. But I want to keep it fun as well. I don't want it to be scholarly, because that bores me.
Yeah.
You know, it's not entertaining, and I want it to keep it entertaining.
Well, for my money's worth, you know, I said this to you before, but I think you're really on a roll now, and I created a little bit of an identity within, you know, our community of friends, Facebook friends or what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really cool, because you weren't setting out to do, you know, do this for the feedback only and waiting for that, you know, 10th comment on the blog. I've made it now. It was not that.
No, I met a lot of great people, and I really enjoy the interaction. You know, it's really, really cool.
Might sound a bit daft, but it was the one we'd mentioned about what do you think about being on our network?
Yeah.
What do I think about being on your network? I think it's great, actually, because the first show that Ken and I did, it was actually the first time I've been watching Hong Kong movies for like 15, 16 years. It was the first time I got to actually speak out loud about Hong Kong films. You know, I can type, you know, everything I want on a computer screen, and but this is the first time I actually got to speak to someone and actually interact, and that was great. So you might have created a monster, I don't know.
it was really all what I wanted to do in the first place, where like I did add like 3 or 4 years of like Hong Kong cinema behind me, and there was really just this thing you could talk amongst your friends, and they watch films with me, but they'll only know things that you've given to them. You can't learn anything new or get any recommendations from others, so it was really just like my episode one was just basically like a wee signal out to the internet and see what would come back. And
right.
I did. It snowballed. Like, Ken joined the show and it sleazeballed. And then Mike joined the show. It evened it out. And I did. It was great. Like, every week, just kind of sit down, put it on the headset and talk about Hong Kong cinema for like 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
It was, and it's rare to meet someone and like sit down in a pub and like chat and drink about movies all afternoon. Like, those are those rare exceptions in life.
Yeah, and I didn't have that. My friends thought I was a nut because of I watched movies with subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was tough. So I was like 15 years in the dark, you know, in my room watching movies while the world was going on outside without me.
I want to live in Charlie Joe land. And I might be, in actuality, who knows? I might be in Charlie Joe's type matrix.
I just remembered like a time through the summer where all my friends came to the door. They're like, "Colin, we're going out." And I was like, thinking, it's like, I could go out with my friends or I could finish this review of The Swordsman. And I finished the review of The Swordsman, and then I went out. It ain't that something. It is. Like, you realise, like, man, I'm a different breed.
Yeah, yeah.
But you still, like, had enough... I don't want to say open friends, because that sounds wrong, I guess, but you still could give movies to your friends, too. Like you saw, like, okay, they were known movies, like Old Boy and what have you, but still... I don't have that around me. I mean, Old Boy is harsh stuff, and it is Korean, and it's Asian, it's foreign, so it's not like putting on a Police Academy 4 or anything. You know? It's not easily digestible stuff, regardless, you know what I mean? So I mean, you still have that, Stu.
Yeah.
Maybe, would you say you have, like, Asian friends that are into Asian cinema, or they just watch whatever you hand them?
Exactly. They really just watch whatever I hand them. Or if I was just talking last night with a mate, and said, when was last, like, we used to, like, weekends, like, set up watching movies all through the night, and it was like, man, we really need, like, another Kung Fu marathon. Uh-huh. And I've got, like, so many movies to show them as well, so.
Yeah.
It is great, because it's just something to banter with, something to show these amazing movies to. And at the end of the day, he doesn't need to follow the same lifestyle as me. He doesn't need to, like, stop with the Bruce Willis movies and start with the Donnie Yens. Like, he lives his life his way. Mm-hmm. And fucking just tunes in to whatever I show him and, like, appreciates it as well, so. Mm. Can't ask for anything else.
No,
I want to marry
exactly
him, really.
It's a bro-romance in the making. But yeah, I mean, I should really try that out more often on the friends I hang out with. And I actually did show a friend of mine who I've shown, like, select Hong Kong movies to. I've shown in Drunken Master 2, Police Story. But I did show in Daimajin, you know, a big Japanese kaiju movie, which is all awesome and all that. But he really dug it. He didn't know anything, so he didn't come you know, at it with preconceived notions, but he did acknowledge that he thought the movie was slow and he didn't really know where it was going, but, you know, he got it at the end, you know, what the structure was, why the movie took its time and why it was kind of cool to only have the monster, you know, becoming alive during the last 10 minutes rather than throughout the film. So that was rather cool, and thankfully it was a short movie too, because I wouldn't dream of, like, sitting down a friend in front of, you know, A Touch of Zen. You know, a big 3-hour awesome movie, but still a 3-hour movie and pretty damn difficult to get into as well.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty arty and pretty, like, you know, that ending is, I don't know if it's Taiwan's answer to, like, the puzzling 2001 ending. You know, the Stanley Kubrick ending, because I don't know what goes on during 2001's ending. Mm. Aside from the fact that it's pretty... pretty colors, you know, it's an acid trip, but the ending of A Touch of Zen is quite abstract as well. I like that connection now that I thought of it. You know, we have an Asian 2001, and it's called A Touch of Zen.
Last movies watched, and we'll just hand the ball back to Jared.
All right, I guess one of my last movies watched, a movie from 1992. It's called Angel Hunter. And it reportedly sat on the shelf for a year or two. And it was directed by Sun Chung, who used to do some Shaw Brothers stuff. I guess Big Bad Sis and Human Lantern were two of his, I guess, more well-known movies. He also did City War with Chow Yun-Fat and T. Lung. So Angel Hunter is listed as his last movie, and it's kind of an obscure movie. I just found it recently on Laserdisc, and that's how I watched it. And it's weird that it's hard to find, because it has an all-star cast. Anthony Wong is in it, Lau Ching Wan is in it, Carrie Ung, Oman Tat, Valerie Chow. So it's weird that it's very hard to find, very difficult to find. I've never seen a DVD, never seen a VCD. Have you, Ken?
No, I think I see in front of me in my mind the LaserDisc cover, but I've never seen it elsewhere.
I think it was released on World Video VHS, but I haven't seen that yet. Yeah.
World Video is not Tai-Seng, let's say that.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And it's 1992, I think I said, and this is an odd one. This is like nothing you've ever seen before from Hong Kong. It's very stylish. It's very overwrought, but it deals with religion, in a cool way, in a thriller like way. As the story goes, a teenage schoolgirl is found dead, and Lau Ching Wan, he plays a social worker for the school. And he was in previous contact with her, so he kind of takes it upon himself to solve the mystery of her murder. So he hooks up with a friend of the deceased girl, played by Valerie Chow, and she is also curious as to how her friend was killed. So while mourning her death, she comes across Carrie Ng, and Carrie Ng is kind of this sleek and sexy recruiter for this religious cult that Valerie Chow's friend was involved in. And the word cult is never, I don't think it's ever said in the movie, and in the subtitles it's called heresy. So this cult, they prey on like wayward teens. So she kind of snags Valerie and brings her into the clan. And crossing this action is Lau Ching Wan's investigation. So he hooks up with an old batshit crazy religious scholar played by Ng Man Ta. And there's this really out of place comedy because of Ng Man Ta. It's so out of place. It's the film builds up this thriller like foreboding atmosphere, dark music cues, and then there's one scene where Lau Ching Wan meets Ng Man Ta at his apartment, and Ng Man Ta is like showing him a slideshow of all these cults around the world, and then he comes across these slides of naked women just placed into the slideshow. And then he starts bumbling, oh, that's not supposed to be there. And then he clicks again, another slide of a naked woman. And then he clicks again, another slide of a naked woman. So it kind of goes on. It's so out of place, but this was like, early 90s Hong Kong cinema, and that's the way it went. And so you go along with it. It doesn't play against the movie. It kind of makes it a little more tolerable, a little more fun. So the cult leader is played by Anthony Wong. And this was it was fun to see him. He kind of had like that long wavy hair that he wore in Full Contact, mm-hmm. like yeah. a dirty hair, like a perm, and he had this sleazy pencil thin mustache. Yeah, so it was really cool. And he and Carrie Ng have a little steamy kind of relationship, and there are a couple of scenes where they go at it pretty, not Category 3 like, but coming pretty close to Category 3. This cult, this religion plot crosses with a political plot. And if you want to further it, you can, say it's like a separation of church and state if you want to go, go that angle. But I don't want to give too much away because this is, it's really a fascinating movie. And it's a shame that it's hard to find. Really a shame.
The title always jumps at you in the following way. Ooh, is Moon Lee starring in that? Another angel.
Yeah.
That, whoa, there's no Moon Lee. Where's Sibel Hu? Where's Yukari Oshima? Well, the title kind of makes sense now. It's not a, it's not an Angel Retake 5 or 10.
No,
or 15.
No. But it's the backdrop is a drama, but it's peppered with other genres like that out of place comedy. This really really cool thriller, and at the end it's like a balls to the wall action scene, gun violence. Sweet. That comes out of nowhere. So it's really cool, it's really early 90s Hong Kong cinema flavor, where it was almost every film, like 95% of the films were like everything including the kitchen sink, and it's something that really drew me to Hong Kong cinema in the first place, is how different they were. Every movie was like a hybrid. You couldn't have a straight drama without having dopey comedy, mm-hmm. at least a little segment of dopey comedy. And this just blends all these genres into one, and it's really satisfying. It really is.
Done
I think
right.
you like
and,
it.
Yeah, usually it is tolerable. It's not like this mix goes wrong 9 out of 10 times, and this is one of those, 10th effort that kind of made it. It was right, like one day I just all over the place. There's a lot to, like, you know, at least I could have the comedy, at least I could have the possible TNA. You can always take something away from it.
Right, right. And it's I'm not sure why it sat on the shelf for a year or so, but maybe it was the religion in the film, or maybe the audience didn't want to see a film about cults. I have no idea, because to me the film is no different than other films from the era. It's extremely, extremely entertaining. Yeah, there's some like wild scenes too. Like during this like cult induction ceremony for Valerie Chow, Lao Ching-Wan and Uman Ta sneak in as like new congregants, so to speak. You know, and after giving Valerie the sacrificial wine, Anthony Wong declares some crap like, "Now it's time to love," and then like this monster Caligula-like orgy ensues.
Sweet.
Yeah, and it's like in this big church warehouse, like, and they're all up on scaffolding, and everyone's hanging off the scaffolding and going at it. It's nuts.
Was this category 3 at all, or?
No, I think it's 2 or 2B. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like something you should show your friends, too. Could show your friends, show Margaret. Look at this, we talked about this on our very respected podcast. It has this and this and this and this and this and this and this. No charming fat, but this and this and this and this and this.
Yeah, but like, watching Wan is in Anthony Wong, there are notable actors in this, so it's it's interesting. It's a very different movie.
Do you think like the likes of Scared Stiff is probably one of the most notorious examples of this Hong Kong cinema mix? Because I just thought of, you know, since we did the commentary for it, me and Stu, we talked about that a lot.
Yeah, this is, I guess, in a similar vein. You know, there is that mix. There is no separation of genre. It's just all thrown in and blended and, you know, or thrown up against the wall and whatever stuck. And I that's the type of Hong Kong movie that I relate to, that I like, and that's why I love this era in Hong Kong film so much. So like now, today, I guess Hong Kong movies kind of strayed a little from this hodgepodge, I guess. Yeah. But you do still get it, and people kind of call it out, like, oh, the movie's uneven. It's like, wait a second, you know, when you first got into Hong Kong movies in the 90s, that's all there was this uneven movie, and you loved it, and now 20 years later, you're dismissing the movie because of the same elements that you used to love. So I kind of have to call, you know, bullshit on that sometimes. Like, all right, uneven is uneven is uneven.
I mean, think back, guys, to like the opening of A Better Tomorrow. There's this whole wacky sequence in the concert hall where I think Emily Chu is auditioning in front of Choi Hawk, and Leslie Cheung is being really goofy in the scene too. You know, it's part of A Better Tomorrow, this classic movie.
Yeah.
And it doesn't dominate the film, obviously, this goofy side, but it was there in a classic movie. So.
Right. Or even Hard Boiled with the baby peeing out the fire. You know, it's something silly, but it's part of Hong Kong cinema.
Can you see Donnie Yen having a baby pee on him like today?
Regularly, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so see it, find it, definitely. Angel Hunter.
So, speaking of Donnie Yen, I got around to watching Ip Man 2 last night, and the movie still works. Definitely, it is really just a fucking fun film. Like, that was what spurred the conversations. Like, dude, you need to, like, we need to watch Ip Man 1 and 2 back to back. Like, fuck it, we need to go on a marathon. They're just, like, kung fu movies I've not watched yet. And it was, like, the movie does have this great magic to it where Donnie Yen is becoming really huge in, like, Hong Kong cinema. He's undoubtedly dominating it. You can't, like, turn left or right without bumping into fucking Donnie Yen here and Donnie Yen there. He's, like, there is no other choice but Donnie. And
we need someone to play Eric Tsang's wife. Call Donnie. Or have Eric Tsang play Donnie's wife. You can do that as well. Eric has
Eric Tsang, he's in everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd just be the fucking scene at Donnie's house and the phone rings, then he just does that big, like, 1 million fucking Hong Kong dollar smile, go ding, like the big, like, damn you, Donnie. He'd make a sweet wife. And so, Ip Man 2 really picks up right after the end of the first one, where Grandmaster Ip Man escapes Fu San and travels to Hong Kong, and tries to open up Wing Chun Studio and just basically start earning his keep as a martial arts instructor. And it's harsh times at first. His land ends up getting used for, like, just elderly women to hang out their washing on because he's got no students. But eventually does get, like, for the second, this one dude walks in, like, he's this cocky guy, smooth black hair, and he's like, no, this can't be Bruce Lee. They're not. I'm trying to think of the, like, wait, he was old when Bruce Lee, but Donnie can never get old. And, like, is it, well, people just ignore fact and say, ah, come on, let them be a tag team. But it wasn't. That saved for the very end of the movie. But it does, it has this great, it's just like a great martial arts movie, and you can't say that much nowadays. Mm. A great period martial arts movie.
Well, you can't say that. You can't say that because there aren't many. You know?
Exactly. It is. It's not. Like, last year we got Bodyguards and Assassins, but that had a lot of drama built into it first. Like, with Ip Man, it really, like, 10 minutes, then there's a kick-ass fight scene. And it gets kick-ass. Like, Fansu Wong's brought back, is like, nice, he's brilliant, he was in the first one. And then they bring out fucking Sammo Hung, he's like, holy shit, yes! And he comes in, and then they have like a Donnie Yen can't really teach Wing Chun in the area without basically being accepted by all the other teachers, so he has to challenge and fight the teachers. And it's just a good excuse to bring out, like, Fung Hak on and, ooh, just other memorable faces. And it's like, man, you guys are just giving us treats now. Right? Like, you are catering for this audience, like, this, like, classic martial arts movie audience right away. Yeah. And the action is fast. It doesn't look to the point where you're watching it, like, fast forward. Like, nowadays, I feel every time I see clips of Fist of Legend, it's like, that's so fast. These him and Chin Tzu Ho are like, just what, man? Slow down. It looks ridiculous now. And but this looks too real. Just Donnie Yen just goes and just fucking starts. Damn, this man's moving so fast. And
it sounds like Fist of the North Star there, almost like, you know, that fast.
And it is just fucking awesome action and, like, smooth wire work. Like, he's not jumping up to the ceiling going, yeah, and then flies back down. There's none of that. Yeah. And it's just creative fight scenes as well. Like, oh, just such a good fucking film. And then it takes this evil turn when, like, the fucking cookie cutter Western devil comes in. And, I mean, I thought bad foreigner overacting was a thing of the 80s. I never knew they could actually still have bad bad Western actors today in Chinese movies.
Oh, how wonderfully you connect our discussion to, like, this is happening now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of being like, I think it's one of the points where it was criticized, you know, the bad Western acting. But you didn't see that, you know, when you had fucking Louis Roth in A Better Tomorrow 2, like, saying, this fucking fried
exactly.
rice stinks.
That's exactly my point. And that's, I saw Ip Man 2, and I loved it. And, like, you were saying that people saw this Guaylo actor overact and act just so horrible, and they hated it. And I was like, oh, I love that. I love that. Thank you. Thank you for being that horrible.
Was this Darren Shalabi by any chance?
Yes. Twister. Right. And it was so crazy, and it's just parts, like, I reckon it just, like, there must be, like, a wee pep talk. So, right, okay, I know there's a language barrier between you and the Chinese people, but everyone will understand you perfectly if you shout loud, if you talk like this. Like, you yellow piece of fat. Like, seriously, like, just speaking loud will overcome any language barrier. And you're like, oh, Lord. And yes, that man is talking as if he's got a hand up his arse working him. He can't stop shouting. And it's like, it does. It's like, this man's a prick. Can't wait to see him get his ass kicked. And, like, it leads into this. Like, he is the cunt that you want to get killed so much. Mm-hmm. Like, the way he disrespects the Chinese, and it urges into this great battle, and, like shit happens. And,
I mean,
and
you don't need to reinvent these cliches because in old timey martial arts movies, you know, the versus the Japanese plot that was in a million movies, including Fist of Fury. We many times on this podcast mention comfort, you know, with actors, and it's true with cliches as well. Even in 2011 or 2009 or 10 when this was made.
Aye, and you're right, it is a sense that, like, they are reinventing the wheel, but the wheel's a good invention, people. Like, these are some work out to be some really good movies because you get emotionally invested in it and you get a great payoff at the end. Most of the times, I don't think there's an occasion where the Western Devils win, but it does. It was actually making me think, like, I wonder if, like, I'm enjoying this film immensely, and it's like, I know nowadays there's no way they could like make one of these every week, but this just reminds me so, this could have been so much like the Wong Fei Hung movies, where Wong Fei Hung and this, because like, Ip Man was like, Ip Man versus the Japanese, like Ip Man 2 versus Western Shouty Devil, and like, it was a great story, and once it finished, it was like, More, and it might possibly like Ip Man and Bruce Lee. Well, I think it's probably finished now, but like,
we have one Kawaii sometime making sometime.
But fucking fun film. I was really enjoyed it. It was just, it ticked all the right boxes, and. Yeah, they just done it right. I may be the person that can't find a bad Wilson Yip movie, but
like, Skyline Cruiser.
Okay, I've not read that one yet. Yeah.
Stay away from that one.
So yeah, definitely like two thumbs up for me. Like, great film. I will watch that movie again. I really want to have a back-to-back like Ip Man double bill. And one thing that's going to be really interesting is Wong Kar Wai's, like, the Grand Master.
I hope, like, it's interesting. Oh, praying it's interesting.
Because it's going to be, like, because let's see, he done 2046, and then he done, what was it, Blueberry Nights?
Ugh.
And there's been nothing since.
Yeah, because he's still fucking making this movie. I heard someone... I don't know where I heard this, but someone had heard from a crew member from the Grandmaster or Grandmasters that they were essentially wondering, they didn't know when the shoot was over. Like, they didn't put a time frame on it. Oh, who the hell does that? Well, Wong Kar Wai does. You know, you set a shooting schedule when you make movies, like 90 days, and that's fucking it. But
he's an auteur, yeah, he's more important than everyone else.
Yeah. It might be the case of where, what's it? It's got to have, like, it'll do the thing where young Ip Man, and then he turns, gets a bit older, and then he'll finish with old Ip Man. And it's like, no creative effects. See, well, we'll just wait till he ages. It's like, deliver this line. It's like, no, a little bit older. Like, wait, how? Like, no, a little bit older. Come back tomorrow, we'll do the same line again. It's not the right age yet, but, I mean, we're here, the set's built. We'll give him a week, then come back. It might be a good job security for the crew because, like, fuck, this payday ain't ending anytime soon. I mean, so far it's only produced a poster.
Some teaser trailer that didn't show any footage, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
There's a teaser trailer with the 50-second teaser trailer with 30-second filming company logo and then some credits on a black background. Coming soon. I don't look for Wong Kar Wai movies anymore. I want to see the back catalogue, though, that I haven't seen to see if he's got it. I haven't seen Days of Being Wild, for instance. I love Ashes of Time.
I love that.
I have Ashes of Time. You have Chungking Express.
Okay. So, okay. Well, we'll do. I'll deal with that.
Yeah. And I haven't seen In the Mood for Love, so you know, I'll judge when the time comes. You know what I mean? So.
Mm-hmm. Ken, last movie's watched.
Thanks, Stu. Righto. I like talking about the cut-and-paste people, but I will and won't this time. Because I found a bit of an oddity called Satanic Crystals.
Ooh.
Oh, that's a great title. Yeah. It's produced by Thomas Tang of Filmark, the kind of rival company to IFD, but it's actually a real movie that they produced. It's not a movie they bought and put Westerners into and ninjas into. It's a real movie real Hong Kong movie starring Leung Gai An, and Xing Fei On is in there as well. But it does utilize both Hong Kong Western and Thai talent, but it's original footage. And it's a take on an Indiana Jones style adventure. It's from 1989, by the way. So it's Leung Gai An looks cool, and everybody looks good and cool. And but still, it's kind of drab looking, and at times as incoherent as a cut and paste Phil Marx IFD type of production. But still, it. At heart, you only need to know that many people are after the colored jade stone. You know, that's all people are after. Including the director, who's also the bad guy. It's a guy called Chen Keying, who sports some mean sideburns. Kind of lower low style sideburns.
Oh, Lord.
Lower low from Rosa and Chicken and Duck Talk and what have you. He has those kind of sideburns. They're really cool. And in terms of action, I mean, certain stunts and action comes off as both choppy and shoddy, but overall it has that fun energy, and it also has some fun violence to carry the movie into, you know, decent entertaining territory, completely harmless, and even has some goofy detours into exploitation where our lead, Leung Gai An, even has the sex scene. A fairly brief one, if I remember correctly. And there's some gory encounters with the animals of the jungle, if you're into that. Hong Kong filmmakers certainly never shied away from that. But the priming highlight in ingredient comes in the form of a radio-controlled helicopter that plays a wonderful part in the finale. And that's all I have to say about it. Actually, it's one of those things like 5 minutes or... Or let's say 85 minutes are like so-and-so, that part was cool, the last 5 minutes rock, and therefore the movie is totally memorable, you know what
like
I mean?
That sometimes that's all you need.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. An RC helicopter, for fuck's sake. You know, and not in a like in a Charlie Cho way where he uses it as a peeping tool. No, this is part of the action, you know what I mean? So it's kind of a hard movie to find. I think it was on Laserdisc in Hong Kong. I got a copy of a German DVD that has English dubbing on it as well.
Oh, cool.
So it's all good fun, and you can't go wrong with kind of a title like Satanic Crystals. But they never, you know, have Satan coming out of the crystals or anything like that. That would be too high budget for a movie that Thomas Tang produced. But and I wouldn't be surprised if, because Thomas Tang could claim ownership to this, I wouldn't be surprised if he actually did, you know, spliced up the movie and put ninjas and other westerners into it. Because they, you know, IFD did that as well. They had the property. We can just, you know, why acquire, you know, new movies when we can use the old movies and all the old Richard Harrison footage, all the old Garfield phone footage. Let's reuse that. So it's all good fun. All good fun. That's my scholar view of it all, on it all. And as I said, Xing Fei On and Uma Dutt is in it as well, in both playing serious roles. So say Xing Fei On playing Triad Heavy, if you ever seen him play that. It happens every now and again. He shouts a little
I'm
bit.
Not familiar. Yeah.
Mild-mannered Xing Fei On, the legend. Yeah. So that's all there is to say, really.
Cool.
Would be cool.
I
want to
see.
Look at eBay for the laser disc of it to find the original language print. Maybe that's cool to have as well. So that's me. Short and sweet for once.
So that's conclusion of our first hour. Tune in soon for Pirate 2.
So, welcome back. After me, Stu, and Jared were done, I thought to myself, why not fill this hour with a little bit more content? And I thought back to the old Christmas special of 2010, where I was unable to attend because I was ill. I was very sad to not be able to attend because we got some great guests on that show. And one of them is back, and it's V-Cinema's Coffin John.
Hello everyone, how's everyone doing?
And, of course, gotta thank everyone for listening, because they donated in some shape or form, and emailed in receipts for donations, so thanks very much, and thanks for coming on, John, on Benefit Pod.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I also want to thank anyone who has donated to the Japan quake relief effort, whether it's was from the behest of, you know, us or Podcasts on Fire, us, I should say, meaning VCinema, or Podcasts on Fire or whatever website, or just out of the goodness of your own heart, because as we're going to talk about in this short segment that I'm guesting on, it's very important for people like us to do so.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about what Japan Society is in this case?
Right. So we chose the Japan Society of New York mainly because, one, because of our affiliation with their film program, of which they have an excellent, excellent film program, which is primarily curated by Mr. Samuel Jaumier, I believe is his last name. And they hold the Japan Cuts Film Festival every summer, as well as many other retrospectives and film programs throughout the year. So part of that is sort of to give back to what they're doing for the film community, in that they're, you know, helping promote especially Japanese film at their center, which is located again in New York. You know, I think it's the case that when anyone makes a donation to a particular cause, they want to know that the majority of their money, and hopefully 100% of their money, is going to go directly to the people who need it the most. So, for example, those who are, in this case, suffering because of the quake or who have suffered. And, of course, the rebuilding project that will eventually have to be undergone. So the Japan Society of New York, they had pledged 100% of the funds to go to the to those who are suffering or have suffered from the quake and the ensuing tsunami. So first thing we want to be able to tell our listeners, our readers, our fans and friends of our various sites is that the money that you're donating is not going to us, you know, the bloggers and podcasters and writers of the sites, for one thing, because, you know, I think that's the first thing that people are a little concerned about, is that, you know, if I click this link, is it an affiliate link in which, you know, 2% gets kicked back to the site, the original site in which I clicked the link, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, a lot of people do that with Amazon, for example. You know, we could have chosen other organizations like, you know, Red Cross, for example. But again, we wanted our listeners and readers to know that the funds would go, again, 100% directly to the people who need it the most. So, you know, and I'm not trying to downplay Red Cross or say that donating to them is bad, but there are organizations, and Red Cross is one of them, in which administrative fees have to be taken out and of, you know, your donation, because rightfully so, it does take a lot of money to be able to distribute funds and figure out, you know, in what sectors and what areas of a particular country that the funds are needed the most. And, you know, you have to pay people to be able to do that, in other words. You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, you're paying for the, that's why they call them administrative fees, you know, I guess, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. It's very connected. All, you know, the culture that you've experienced is very connected to all of this, obviously. I think I've been affected quite a bit more than, I wouldn't say more than usual, and I'm not a cynical or nihilistic person in any way, but
sure.
This hit my heart in a way that, you know, it affects a whole lot more than just, you know, a coastal town or a town here and there. You kind of get that thought process that, you know, the things you adore and love are now, you know, directly affected by something real. You know, we're
right.
Not talking fiction anymore. We're not talking
right.
And so I think it's a good time to be appreciative as well,
right.
As well as doing what you can. I mean, I for one, I mean, my main focus is Hong Kong, but there's no shortage of appreciation for Japanese culture in my world. But really, what Do you even remember what like took you into like Japanese culture or Japanese movie fandom? If we're talking about movies, do you even remember what like started it all?
Yeah, sure. And actually, if I remember correctly, last year you had a guest on by the name of August Rigoni. Mm-hmm. He was the author of the A.G. Tsuburaya Masters of Monsters book.
Yes.
Even though he's a little older than I am, we were basically raised on the same diet of, you know, of course, regular American culture, but we were lucky enough to have a local TV station by the name of KTVU, mm-hmm. Channel 2, for those of us, for those of you listeners who actually live in the Bay Area. But in the early 70s, I think it was late 60s, early 70s, on into basically the early 80s, they programmed a lot of Japanese TV shows and movies. So you could see Godzilla on Saturday afternoons, basically almost every Saturday afternoon, you know, along with all the other Saturday afternoon movie, you know, American TV movie types of things that you could see. At the time, anyway. Mm. And, you know, there was stuff like Ultraman, Kamen Rider, which I was a really big fan of when I was young. And then from there, I think my interest in Japanese culture sort of blossoms from you know, having classmates who were Japanese, like, exchange students in elementary school. And also some, this is something that a lot of people don't really think of, is that one of my best friends was Taiwanese. And Taiwan, because, you know, Japan had occupied that country for quite a while, there is still a lot of Japanese culture there. And my friend had a lot of things like a lot of early anime and manga. Of course, they were written in Chinese, but, you know, you could definitely tell that they were Japanese as far as, you know, you'd recognize things like, what was it, like Battle of the Planets, for example. You know, like you say, oh, yeah, those are the same characters. They're not speaking English like on TV, but, you know, so he'd have all these videos and like manga and stuff like that. And from there, actually, you know, I started getting into, you know, I think I've told people on my show before that I'm Asian American, I'm Chinese American, and I became very aware of being Asian American around middle school. So that would be around when I was maybe 13, 14 years old. Mm. And I translated that to... I never really connected, I think, well with Chinese culture. The reason being is because, you know, China for a long time was not only communist, but sort of isolationist. So a lot of the pop culture, which, you know, as a child, you're kind of more interested than traditional culture. So a lot of that pop culture didn't really filter into the United States. You know, this was back in the late 70s and early 80s. So, you know, I got interested not so much in being Chinese American, but in being Asian American. So, you know, I was getting into things like, you know, Hong Kong cinema and Japanese cinema. You know, my hero, who's still my hero, is Bruce Lee, you know. Mm. You know, all these things that represented, you know, this sort of pan-Asian ideal, you know, of course, mixing with the American side of things, too. So from that, you know, I would just basically try to expose myself to anything that was vaguely Asian sounding. So, you know, I would go to the video store and say, like, oh, hey, this movie looks, you know, it's black and white, but hey, this director sounds like he has an Asian name. You know, back then I wasn't sure what the difference was between, like, Korean and Chinese and Japanese so much. Yeah. So I would just, like, get all these movies, I'd just start watching them, and, you know, I would, you know, I guess the famous example that I always bring up is that I once watched Ozu's Tokyo Story, Tokyo Story, and I remember enjoying it. This was, again, when I was, like, 14 years old, but thinking, like, there's some part of that I really don't understand, you know? It's like, I understand the story, like, you know, it's a sweet story about growing away from each other, about, you know, family, you know, things like that. But as a child, I kind of thought, there's something I'm not getting out of this, and I can't figure out what it is. So that kind of drove my interest in Japanese cinema, because I started to realize that I could learn a lot about culture through cinema, you know, which to me was interesting because, you know, being American, you know, we learn about different cultures through, you know, I mean, like, I've had friends who were, you know, whose parents and grandparents, etc., from all different countries, but you never really get to know them on a really intimate basis because, you know, when you're in America, you think, I'm American, so I should be American. Mm. You know, but when you finally get exposure to this cinema that is purely, well, not maybe not 100% purely, but, you know, for the most part, you know, belonging to a completely different kind of culture, then you can feel like you're learning something new, or at least you have some touchstones in which you can pursue, for example, you know, what is it about family in Japan that's so different from family in the United States, you know, through Tokyo Story, for example.
What I wanted to mention again about my reignition that happened, that people might have expected me to go all out and watch the entire Pink Films catalog, if you will, as soon as we did our Japan on Fire series, because it fits with the kind of movies I like, my exploitation movies, my erotica movies and all of that, and cult movies in general. But it, so, and I do love your Lady Snowblood and Female Prisoner movies, you know, I've only seen one of them, but they're great. But it ended up still being, you know, the kaiju genre and exploring that to its fullest, which there's no shortage of fun there for me, which is always it's an endless well currently for me, because I've not seen maybe a tenth of compared to what other people have experienced. And one of my greatest discoveries was seeing the Daimajin trilogy of movies for the very first time, not knowing anything about them beforehand, and there that was this insanely entertaining and kind of affecting trilogy of films as well. So it's for me as a Hong Kong fan, it's always nice to jump over to Japan for a little bit to see, you know, to see a different side. I think it's the easiest explanation, because the production values were so different and the trends were so different compared to Hong Kong during the same time, let's say 60s, 70s.
But I think there's something to be said about, you know, not only watching them just for the purpose of enjoyment, but also, again, to stress here that, you know, through our appreciation of film and Asian film, you know, in this case, Japanese film, that, you know, we can hope to understand a culture better and to be empathetic towards, you know, causes like the Japan quake relief.
But we started what we could and done what we could so far to segue into a nice conclusion to all of this. So, you know, again, thanks everybody for donating to this podcast to Japan Society, that we support via this podcast. And thanks, John.
Thank you.
So as he's been so kind to the show before, being hit hard by Jet Li on film, it's a wealth of knowledge and just a cool, nice guy to have on. I thought it would be cool to catch up a little with author and fight choreographer John Krang to ask what's up. So, what's up, John?
What's up? I recently did this documentary for you guys over in Europe, for CineAsia, it's called Bruce Lee Memories of the Master, and it's going to be in the Young Bruce Lee DVD. So you guys get to see what my ugly mug looks like.
It's the sole purpose of the documentary. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's all for the documentary. No vanity.
For some reason, they muted my audio and just focused on my face for 30 minutes.
Yeah, well, you know, they should have done the Clutch Cargo thing. You know, I don't know if you guys get that cartoon over there. It was really a ghastly cartoon where they just had the cartoon faces and they kind of superimposed real lips.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. They did that on Conan, didn't they, with the Arnold impressions and all that. It was kind of connected to that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what they should have done. They should have put on, you know, like...
So mean. That would be so mean. Do a really silly voice. I'm John Krang. No, guys, you were cool to me. What are you doing?
No, but it was fun. It was a fun shoot. It was a whole afternoon we did it, and then my friend David Tandon was, you know, produced and directed it. So, and we've been friends for God since the early '90s. You know, we were both before I became a writer. I was before I wrote for the magazines. We were both these Bruce Lee diehard fans, and you know, we'd always go down to Chinatown and try to look at some of these check out some of the places and see if they had any old Bruce Lee stuff. And we found some amazing stuff. He found like this one magazine that was done back in the early '50s, where they had these. It was a movie magazine, and you saw, you know, they were promoting Bruce's, you know, one of Bruce's Hong Kong teen movies, and he bought it for like $5. Yeah. it was amazing.
Should be a collector's item in some circles, maybe. Yeah.
Oh yeah. They said, oh yeah, because we always can't. We'd come by and, you know, they go, oh yeah, we got this, we got that. You know, what do you think? And you know, we'd snatch it up. Yeah, you know, when I started writing for the magazine, he would come along with me and help me out. And he became a writer, and he published. He's written 9 books on Bruce Lee right now. So.
Wow.
He's a great guy. He's a great historian, David Tadman. You know, and he's a great guy. He knows his Bruce Lee history really, you know, like the back of his hand. Mm. He's really, really knowledgeable in it.
It's so amazing that you can extract so much still from that very short career, really.
Yeah. Yeah, what's amazing about Bruce is, if you look at his life, you know, he only lived to be 32 years old. And what he did in that 32 years is amazing. I mean, it's like he accomplished so much in that short amount of time. I mean, it kind of makes you look at yourself, you know, and think about, you know, wow, you know, I really need to step up. I need to get my act together and get out of my own way.
I'm 32 years old this year, so I'm definitely now I got to do something.
No, I mean, yeah, you know, it just you know, he definitely followed his bliss. He knew what he wanted. You know, and he went for it. I mean, if you look at all the stuff he did, you know, like, I mean, he had a learning curve. You know, I was, how was that? I did this commercial for FX, the Fox channel here, and they own all the Green Hornet, the series that he was in. Hmm. So they decided to do a Green Hornet marathon, and we knew one of the guys that owned the Black Beauty. So they asked me if I would be interested in shooting a commercial, and I got to play Kato, and I got to choreograph my own fight scenes, and I got to act opposite of Van Williams. Yeah, that was just like, oh my God. So I even drove that Black Beauty, you know, and it was just like, that was, I drove it, and I was like, oh my God, I could die now.
I'm just going to try this in LA traffic for the rest of the afternoon, and
Oh man, yeah, it's a '66 Chrysler Imperial. That car's got so much pickup. You know, it's a muscle car. Mm-hmm. It's not like these little 4-cylinder engines today. You know, I mean, you felt it when you started up that car. You're like, oh my God, there's some serious horsepower underneath my feet. Mm-hmm. You know, and I got to do that, and I acted opposite Van Williams, and I got to you know, hang out with him for a whole day, and we just talked, and it was interesting. He told me a lot of things, and he said that Bruce didn't understand fights at the time. You know, he would just knock out something, and nobody would want to come back. Mm. And then what happened was, you know, he took him to the screening room where the executives were watching the fights, and they were laughing at what he was doing, because what he was doing was really in close stuff, you know, and you know, Bruce got kind of pissed. He goes, yeah, nobody laughs at what I do. He goes, all right, teach me what I need to do. Mm. It wasn't him that taught it. It was actually the stunt coordinator on the show that was also Van Williams' stunt double, Benny Dobbins,
right,
who actually was a coordinator. So he showed him what needed to be done. You know, this, you gotta pull back, you got to do this, you got to do that. And it was a real learning experience for him. If you look at what he did in that movie and then compare it to, you know, what he did in, you know, even up to Long Street, you know, and there was a huge difference. I mean, he really devoted you know, a lot of time and energy and learn what he needed to do. And even, you know, there's even a change when he was in The Big Boss, even up to Game of Death.
Definitely.
You know, there's huge. Yeah, huge. I mean, he really, he always bettered himself. He never said, well, I'll let this one, I'll let this one skate. He never let things skate it. You know, he sucked the marrow out of life. If you guys are interested, I at the Showbiz Expo in at the LA Convention Center in Los Angeles, California, I'm going to be teaching a workshop called Fight Choreography for Filmmakers. I'm going to be essentially explaining to filmmakers the three acts of a fight scene. No matter how long or short it is, it should have three acts to it. Mm-hmm. Different elements that make a successful fight scene and elements that, you know, the common mistakes that you see in fights, no matter how big or small the budget is, that often go, you know, overlooked. And also, I'm going to be talking about how professional fighters don't make good film fighters. Mm-hmm. Because what they do is they're counterintuitive to what they've learned as a professional fighter. You can't, you know, like show emotion or telegraph, which is what you have to do as a film fighter. You have to show your intent. You have to show all this stuff so the audience can get emotionally involved, which is why Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee and all these people are famous internationally when they don't have to speak the language. You know, it goes beyond language, and that's very hard to do. I mean, I've had to train actors to do this, and they think in the beginning, oh, it's really easy, but when you're actually doing it, I go, yeah, I want you to punch him, I want you to do these kick combinations, and I want you also to emote this emotion while you're doing it. They go, oh, that's really hard, and not many people can do it. Not many people can do it successfully.
Right. When is this seminar again, John?
Oh, it's May 7th at the Showbiz Expo. Just go to showbizexpo.com and it'll tell you where to go. You know, it's fairly reasonable. I think they're going to charge you an arm and a leg for it, but I'm not exactly sure how much they charge it, but I don't want to say. But yeah, it's pretty reasonable. You know, if you're interested in how to do fight scenes, you know, or action, you know, please come by and say hi.
Cheers for doing it, John. It's for a good cause and all that.
No, dude, anytime. Anytime. Yeah, for you guys, anytime.